This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. If you wonder why animals do some of the amazing things they do, we'd love to hear from you. Here's our number, 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And as always, we have another special topic to share, Patricia.
That's right. You know, people have wondered for years about how other animals see the world. And today we'll find out whether horses can see the same colors that we see.
You mean Mr. Ed didn't only see in black and white?
Right.
We watched him in black and white.
Right.
I assumed that it was the same, you know. Same for him as it was for us.
Good thinking, Larry. Never actually went there myself.
Well, I'll tell you what. We'll also hear the story about a special buffalo named Charlie and the Texas couple who fell in love with him. And that's all still to come. But first, let's take some of your calls. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Patricia. This is Kathy calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Kathy, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
I have a question on animal behavior.
Okay.
Not a problem behavior. This is in the canine category. It's more of a curiosity on my part. I have four grand dogs, and two of the four exhibit this behavior. Maggie, who is a husky German pointer mix and a real sweetheart, and Jackson, who is a Wisla.
Mm-hmm.
They both do this. At certain times, they take their favorite toy in their mouth and hold it and walk around with it. These certain times would be when they first get up in the morning, and then when their people come home, or maybe when a visitor comes.
Yes. I know exactly what you mean. As a matter of fact, I have two dogs who do the same thing. They will, when you come home, they will run and get the toy, and then they come up and as if they were showing it to you,
mm-hmm.
but they don't want you to take it. They just want, or you can take it and say, oh, that's a great toy, and they give it back to them. It's a great question, and I don't know the answer, but here's what I can tell you. Doesn't it look exactly like a human child at the age of around, I'm thinking maybe 3 or 4, maybe 5, where they have some new toy that they really love and they want to show it to you? They love it, and they're
mm-hmm.
not obsessed with it,
sure.
but really excited about it.
I wonder if it might be similar to like their blankie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a kid's blankie. They go and they pick it up, and for some reason it provides some comfort and perhaps some stimulation, and then they show it to you, but they don't want you to take it. And
right.
I've seen all these little kids who are like they'll come out of the room with their blankie or their little stuffed dog or their doll or their toy, and they want you to look at it, but then you say, Can I look at your dolly? And they're like, oh, no, you can't.
I have a 3-year-old at home who
does she just, do that,
yeah,
Larry? Does
yeah,
Emily
once
do
in
that?
A while. Once in a while,
yeah.
Emily will do that.
And so that's my best guess, is it has something to do with that sort of stage of development where there's an object out there in space that they're really attracted to that's become a kind of a comfort to them, and they're so social that they want to show it to you, but they don't necessarily want to give it to you. It's really cute, isn't it?
Is it certain breeds or certain temperaments of dogs, or is it just kind of hit and miss?
I think that's a very good question, and I think it's related to breed. Breed has an influence in that. Some breeds are simply more likely to be oriented to put things in their mouth. You know, there are
mm-hmm.
more retrievers who do this than there are going to be greyhounds, for example. But there are a lot of individual differences. So I've had probably 3 out of 11 border collies who did it, for example. So there's a lot of personality in there, too.
Thanks, Kathy. That was a great question. Thank you very much for calling. And if you have a question, you can join us at 1-800-462-7413. Patricia, we received an email question from Doug in Fairfax, Virginia, for you. He adopted a small 6-year-old cat about a year ago, and the previous owner apparently declawed both the front and the back
okay.
paws. Doug says he's not a fan of declawing, but
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, me neither, but
he goes on to say that Mookie is very loving, roll on her back, rub my belly lap
yeah,
cat, you know.
God.
And she's alone during the day, and work has him traveling overnight from time to time. To give her some company, can you recommend another pet, a cat or otherwise, to be a housemaid, a playmate for Mookie? Doug volunteers at a local animal shelter, and he's been on the lookout for another declawed cat. What do you think?
I think I think it would be smart to be very cautious here. I cannot tell you the number of people I've had as clients and people who called in on this radio show. Larry will attest to this.
Yes, I will.
Who had one cat and they thought they should get another cat for company, and now they have this huge, terrible problem with aggression between the two cats. Cats, keep in mind that cats come from a wild animal. The African wild cat is their wild type precursor. And this is an animal who spends a lot of time alone. So it's true that a lot of cats are very social. You know, they're very cuddly. They love to be in your lap. That doesn't mean they want another cat in the house. So I'm not convinced that the cat is really suffering and is really feeling lonely. I think a lot of cats don't suffer from loneliness. They don't have the same kind of social systems that dogs and people do. So before you do anything, I would step back and ask yourself, does my cat really need somebody else? And is this a cat? If you think that the cat Mookie does, then the question is, should it be another cat? Because Mookie may like being the only cat in the house.
Yeah. Something to think about. And if somebody else has a question they would like to email us, what's the email address?
Oh, it's easy to do. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org. What could be easier than that?
Well, you might call. Here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And in fact, we have somebody else online, so let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Jib. I'm calling from Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Jib, it's a pleasure. What's on your mind?
Well, my cat I've had for about 8 years. We adopted her and her sister originally and lived in an apartment, and the apartment manager told us we had to give one of them back.
Ooh.
So they were twins, so we didn't know which one we were giving back. We thought we were giving back the more relaxed one, but unbeknownst to us, we kept the more crazy one.
Oh, dear.
And her name is Nanette, and it's been a lot of no-no Nanette ever since.
What does she do?
She is a very high-anxiety cat. It started when she was, you know, late in the kitten stage. She would meow. When she wanted something, she would meow. And she doesn't have a very soft, gentle meow. Her meow is...
Meow.
Yeah, very
meow.
Much. A little bit louder, though. Not. You have a little bit... It's a little bit harsher. Yours is a little soft. So she does meow when she wants things. And primarily what she wants now is food.
There are a couple of things that come to mind. And one is... One is a question about why she's really meowing, and it well may be that she's just meowing for food. But, you know, one of the things that I think happens a lot is that a dog will come to us and scratch our lap, or a cat will start meowing, and we just figure that they want food. So we go feed them, and, you know, they're like us. It's like, well, food, that's fine. You know, it wasn't really what I wanted, but, you know, hey, food's good too, so I'll take that. And then they start learning that they can meow or scratch our paw for food. And it becomes sort of a cycle. So one thing that did occur to me is that since you split these cats up, maybe part of why she was sort of wandering around at night and meowing is she had been bonded to this other individual. Now, they may have hated each other, so it might be a lousy hypothesis.
That's the other alternative.
Meow, I'm so happy. Meow, she's finally gone. But so that's one thing to think about is I think very often, and I find myself falling into it, is that dogs come up or cats come up and they want attention, and we think, gosh, they might want food. And, you know, sometimes they don't. But so a couple things to do. One is, first of all, try feeding her dry free choice. And you might want to use the diet, low-calorie kind of dry kibble, because I don't want you to have a fat cat. But, you know, cats have evolved to eat 5, 6, 7 small meals a day. So mm-hmm. A lot of cats do much better if they can nibble on their kibble. I didn't mean to do that. But so that might be something you might want to think about.
Okay.
Another thing you might want to think about is trying to tire her out in the evening. Is get her just a lot of exercise. See if she'll play with toys on fishing pole like sticks, and see what you can do to interact a lot, get her really busy. So she tends to be a little sleepier maybe during the night. You might also want to try leaving some interactive toys down. There are even videos, no kidding, there are even videos you can get for cats of birds flying around, and there are some cats who sit in front of them and watch them for like a half an hour. So see if you can keep her busy somehow during the day while you're gone. That might help a little bit too. be sure that you're not reinforcing the meowing also. And that's one of the hardest things to do here, because they're meow, meow, meow. And what most of us do is that we ignore it, but we're not really ignoring it because it's driving us crazy. And finally, after 25 minutes of meowing, we go feed them. It's like, oh, okay. And so what that does is inadvertently teach them to meow and to never give up meowing. So be very thoughtful about when you're giving her attention and try to ignore the meowing. And then wait, figure out, there must be a break in there, right? Whether it's 2 seconds or 10 seconds. Figure out what the longest break is and then go out of your way to give her attention when she's mm-hmm. quiet, even if it's only 10 seconds of quiet. And then gradually, and work really hard to never give her attention right after she's meowed. So try all those different things and let's see if that'll help a little bit.
And good luck. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll settle the debate over color blindness in horses. Can they see what we see? I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. Time for this week's topic. And you know, Patricia, you say information about horses and color vision has been kind of contradictory, leaving us to wonder what horses actually see. What's the latest on that?
Well, there's a recent study in the Journal of Comparative Psychology that seems to answer the question definitively, and I thought our listeners might be interested in the result and also in hearing about how they did the study.
Absolutely. What did they do?
Well, Evelyn Hanji and her co-authors trained horses using positive reinforcement, the same kind of reinforcement we talk about here on the radio. Mm-hmm. I think actually they even use clickers.
Oh.
And so the horses were taught to stand in front of a wall, and on that wall there were several different pictures. And the pictures were the standard photos that are actually used to test children for color deficiencies to see how well they see color. And these pictures are basically images with a background of dots of one color. So just imagine a picture, okay, just a whole bunch of green dots. And then there's a circle of dots inside that background that's a different color, say, for example, red.
Okay.
So if the horse could tell red from green, they would see that circle of red. But if they can't see red, it would just look like a picture of just, you know, a whole bunch of green dots, right?
Okay, but how could they tell that the horses were seeing the red dots?
Yeah, that's part of what I loved about the study is the methodology they used to try and figure out what the horses were seeing. And what they did is they reinforced the horses for walking up to the wall and touching the picture that had a colored circle in it. Now, if they couldn't distinguish the two colors that were in that picture, then they wouldn't see a circle, right?
Right.
And they wouldn't know which picture to touch. Now, it took quite a while. It really did. It apparently took some real time to teach these horses that they'd be rewarded for identifying a circle. But once they got it, the results were very clear that they can see blue, violet, and yellows very, very well. But red and green apparently look something like sort of brown looks to us.
Okay. And if I'm not mistaken, dogs see colors the same way, don't they?
They do. And, you know, we think that dogs, as well as horses now, see red and green, something like red-green deficient people see them. But, you know, they also see, they do see differently than people in that they probably see colors much less intensely than we do. You know, if you look at their eyes, dogs and horses have many fewer cones, the cells that are responsible for color perception, they have way fewer cones than humans do. But they have many, many more rods, which are the cells that allow us to see in low light, you know, sort of the black and white. And so it looks as though, as best we can tell, there seems to be a trade-off. Either you can have a lot of cones and have great color vision, or you can have a lot of rods and have great vision in low light. Humans and primates have tended towards the color vision side because of their ecology and behavioral from natural history, whereas dogs, cats, and horses see much better in low light but don't see colors as well.
Well, let's just be glad we don't rely on horses or dogs, for that matter, to follow traffic signals.
You know, actually, that brings up a really good point, because guide dogs for the blind they're taught to read signals, but they have to use the location of the light, not the color itself.
Cool information. And if you would like some more information on this topic, go to our website, callingallpets.org. We'll have some examples of what horses see, and we'll have some links to the study we spoke about today. And right now, we're ready to take some more calls at 1-800-462-7413. Hi there, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Ginny from Baltimore, Maryland.
Hi, Ginny. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
I have a wonderful Labrador Retriever. We adopted her at the age of 4 from the Animals of Defenders Rights. We've had her a year and a half. We love her desperately. It became very apparent that she had issues.
Mm-hmm.
And
what's her name, by the way?
Her name is Erin.
Erin, okay.
And she's very strong, very healthy. But when any truck, we live in the city, and not on a major road, but when a UPS truck or any truck, and in particular the mail truck, goes down the street, she goes absolutely wild. And then, of course, as the mail man or mail woman approaches, it's uncontrollable. We just kind of hang on to everything. It's just an earthquake. We've tried squirting water at her, and that just makes a mess. She foams at the mouth. She skids back and forth. There's nothing coming down hard on her. It's just non-negotiable. We've screamed at her. We've yelled at her. We can't even stop her enough to get her outside. And we've had her a year and a half, so this is a daily occurrence.
Right.
And we love her no matter what, but it's very profound, and it doesn't seem to be lessening at all.
Right. And it sounds as though, from your description, that this is the kind of dog that I describe out of control. I actually use OOC in my case notes. But when I say out of control, I don't mean out of your control. I mean out of her control. She's out of her own control. It sounds like she's truly clinically hysterical. One of the good things about this is it's somewhat predictable. Male men and male women have relatively predictable arrival times. So one of the things you can do is, if you're home, is you can predict when they're going to come. So say they come at noon, you can put her in the backyard at 11, for example, and just try and damp down her response a little bit. Now, if she's away from the front of the house, from the road, from hearing the truck, and she's in the backyard, is she a little better? Or does it make any difference at all?
It doesn't make any difference in her behavior, but it's certainly less destructive to our harvest floor.
Gotcha. So it's easier for you. So, well, that's certainly one thing you can do, and obviously that's not going to cure the problem, but that's a little bit of a help. Another thing I would do, and here's the tricky part, is this is the kind of behavior that you want to try and influence by presenting a modified version of the stimulus. Say the mail comes at noon. And so what you might want to do is at 11:30 is start training her some responses that are incompatible with her becoming hysterical. Try and find some friend with a truck who can help you out and drive partway up to your house to start getting her to listen when she's getting sort of a small version of this particular stimulus. And then find a way to logistically control her so she's not completely out of control. So when this truck does start to come, she's got on a harness, maybe a head halter, and you can just use good physics to just keep her from being hysterical and destroying your wood floors.
Give that a try.
Okay.
Thanks, Ginny. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call if you'd like to join in. And time to take another look at our email box, the inbox. And Gwendolyn from Tallahassee, Florida has something for us. She wants to know this, Patricia. What's your opinion of prong collars? We adopted a dog from a rescue group about 6 months ago. She's about 15 months old now, and she gets excited at the class, on a walk, and at home whenever we have a visitor. Sometimes a strong scent will catch her attention, and she'll be off and running with her leash trailing behind her. We started an obedience class, and the teacher recommended using a prong collar because the dog pulls a lot and is too strong for us to control. Not a choke collar, but it's metal, and it looks scary to me. What do you think?
Well, I'm not a fan of prong collars.
I know that.
Larry's not shocked here, right? Are you all shocked? I'm not a fan of them, and there are a couple of reasons for that. Is, and for people who don't know what they're like, they do look medieval. They have prongs. It's a collar. It's a metal collar, and they're prongs that go towards the dog's neck. And so when the collar tightens, these pieces of metal poke into the dog's neck, all around the neck. And it definitely gets the dog's attention more than a classic training or choke collar that's just a metal chain. But I'm not a fan of them because there's so many things out there that are much better. There are head halters. There's several different brands of them, but they're basically like halters that you put on a horse. And they give you tremendous control. There's a reason we move a horse around with a halter rather than a rope around the base of its neck. If you have a dog's nose, then you have complete control over them.
Yep.
And so we've used those for many years in our classes, in our dog training classes. They can be very, very effective. There's some dogs who just never quite get used to them. Most dogs, when you first put them on, they're like, what is on my face? And they try and paw them off. But many, many dogs get used to them very fast. Some dogs don't. There's another tool that we're using a lot in class now because every dog we put them on, with one exception, I think I would probably 4,000, they don't even notice them. And they're a special kind of a harness that you put around the dog's body, but you don't put the leash on the top like you would a standard kind of harness, which makes things worse, which basically allows the dog to haul you around like a wagon. You put the leash on the front of the dog's chest, and it completely changes the physics. And it works really, really well.
Cool.
I just put my 11-month-old border collie, who would be happy to just haul me around like a sled, with a regular collar, and he just simply doesn't pull against it. Now, if you have a huge dog, sometimes it's not quite enough. But there's no downside to the tools that I mentioned. The prong collar, it does work on some dogs. It does. But it has some real potential for problems. I've seen the prongs go into dogs' necks. It can make some dogs aggressive because it is related to discomfort. There's no way around it.
Yeah.
And so so I would try two of those other tools.
And that's a great question. And again, for emailing us, how do they do that, Patricia?
Oh, it's just simple. Just send us an email to, shockingly, the word pets at WPR.org.
And if you'd like to call us, the number is 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Kelly from Boise, Idaho. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Well, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you, Kelly?
Well, you know, I have a question about my very loving but very destructive 10-month-old Great Pyrenees puppy. You know, we absolutely love him, but we can't leave him alone with anything around. You know, he destroys anything he can get his mouth on when we're there, when we're not. It's if we're not directly, you know, stimulating him somehow. So we've gotten the plug-in, the DAP, you know, the pheromone.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten lots of different puzzle toys.
Good.
You know, we've gotten a bunch of different puzzle toys, given them to him so he can, you know, choose which one he wants and then take that one away or, you know, give that one to him for just a couple days. So that's the only toy he has, and then kind of switch it out every few days so he's not getting bored.
Good.
You know, that's not really working.
It's a good theory,
yeah.
Huh?
You know, and the thing is that he's starting to destroy our furniture now. So,
well, there are two issues here. One is when he's alone, when you're gone, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other is when you're home. So let's do one at a time.
Okay.
How is he housed when you leave the house?
You know, he actually has free reign of our house, which is probably really horrible. We do have another dog. We have a 5-year-old lab, and they do kind of play together when we're gone. They go
okay.
back in the yard and the living room.
You are basically asking a 5-year-old child to sit in a candy store alone all day and not eat any candy. What's wrong with that picture? It's don't. There's no way that this dog is going to be able to do what you want him to do while you're gone. I have an 11-month-old dog, border collie. I would never leave him loose in a million years in my house when I'm gone.
So you crate him up?
Oh, absolutely. He's in a big comfy crate. He's trained to the crate. He loves to be in the crate. So That's job one, is to get... Now, granted, a Great Pyrenees is going to need a great crate. It's true.
Yeah, he's cute. And we talked about crating, but we just couldn't find a crate that was large enough.
They're there. They're out there.
Okay.
I guarantee you. Yep, they're out there. You can buy one. Or, you know, you could figure out some kind of a sort of internal fencing system or something. But you basically... It is not this dog's fault. Absolutely. He's just being a dog. The question is, what I need to ask you, what do you do when he starts to chew on something inappropriate?
You know, we take it away, we give him a toy.
And does it happen?
It's a rewarding night.
It sounds like, that's okay. It sounds like it's happening a lot, though. So in one evening, like last night, how many times did he start to chew on the couch or something?
You know, he actually, twice.
Okay, twice. That's not bad. That's not bad. That's
deal
good.
With that.
There are a couple things I do. And just so I hope I say this to me in hopes it will make you feel better, is my 11-month-old border collie, who's been very, very good in the house the last couple of months. I was working on something. He was in the house. I had my back to him. I turned around. He was ripping huge chunks of carpet off my cat tree.
Just
huge. He was just basically eating this incredibly $200 cat tree. And because he's 11 months old,
right.
You know, that's all there is. So here's what I did is I went, oh, Will, what did you do? And he looked at me like, oh, I don't know. What did I do? And then I sprayed that area with bitter apple.
Okay.
And then I gave him a toy that I'd put a little bit of food inside to attract him back to the toy. And then I watched him really carefully. So use repellents.
Use your voice.
Use your voice.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to have a huge effect on dogs who are relatively sensitive. There's some dogs who are like, yeah, whatever.
Right.
But most Pyrenees tend to be relatively sensitive. So spray things that he chews on problematically and continue to redirect him to something you want him to do.
Okay.
Give that a try and see if that helps. Appreciate your call very much. Thanks for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, learn about an American bison who helped one couple connect with the old American West. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers online archives of the show, pet tips contributed by other listeners, and a complete list of guests featured on the program. Our website is callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Also, the radio store provides a selection of books and training guides featuring advice to deal with multi-dog households and leaving pets home alone. Information and ordering at 800-747-7444. That's 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, we welcome Richard Rosen to the program. Richard, a senior editor at Workman Publishing and the author of several books, and his latest is called A Buffalo in the House, The True Story of a Man, an Animal, and the American West. And it's the story about an abandoned buffalo calf and the couple who rescued it. And the couple were Verl and Roger. And Richard, welcome to the program. First, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Who were Verl and Roger, and why did they decide to take in a baby bison in the first place?
They are a middle-aged couple in Santa Fe, New Mexico, whom I ran into by chance. And he's a retired airline pilot, and Verl Goodnight is a sculptor, a fairly well-known Western artist and sculptor, who is descended from a Texas rancher in the 19th century, who is one of the very few people to whom we owe the survival of the buffalo as a species. Mm-hmm. So she wanted to commemorate her ancestors' decision to start a herd just at the point at which the buffalo were about extinct. She wanted to commemorate it with a big sculpture. But she works only from life, so she needed a baby calf to pose for the sculpture of Mrs. Goodnight nursing two baby calves. And she sent word out around the West if there was an orphan buffalo who needed a home, they would provide it. And so they got a buffalo who turned out to be a fantastic artist model for the first few weeks. You know, as long as you were nursing him during the posing, he would behave himself. And he became a member of the family. But as buffalo do, they kept getting bigger and bigger. And he kept getting bigger and bigger. And with every few pounds he grew, there were new challenges for the owners of a, I won't say pet. It's very important to understand buffaloes can never be pets because, as they say about buffalo, figure out where the buffalo wants to be and then build a fence around
it. Well, I can think about, you know, I understand the size issue, but let's talk about those challenges in addition. Well, I guess you can't hardly not talk about size when you talk about challenges, can
you? I think
you?
Size matters when you're talking about a potentially, what, 2,000-pound animal, Richard?
Potentially and often in reality, a 2,000-pound animal. We're talking at least 1,500 pounds.
Wow.
Eventually.
Wow.
That's after two or three years.
Charlie was the name of the of the bison or buffalo. By the way, bison, buffalo. You know, I've heard that we're not supposed to call them buffalo, but some people do. What's the story on bison versus buffalo? What's the accurate terminology?
Well, the real name of the American buffalo, believe it or not, is bison. Kind of like Duran Duran.
Mm-hmm. Or gorilla gorilla.
Boutros Ghali.
Right.
So a lot of people just use those words interchangeably, and to make it easier, I did too. So every once in a while, I'll throw in the word bison when, of course, I mean buffalo, and I'll do that because you do get tired of writing the word buffalo after a while. But they're the same.
Well, he liked the flowers, and that was one kind of challenge. What were some of the other challenges, some of the other things that he did? I know he used to like to get into the flower bed.
He loved flowers. When he discovered vegetation, he went nuts. Also, when he discovered that he could relieve himself on furniture in the house, he went nuts. He thought this was great. He didn't observe a bathroom etiquette the way a cat does from birth and dogs can be trained to. So there were some huge accidents.
I'm going to stop. He was in the house? We're talking about a buffalo in the house.
Well, the book is called The Buffalo in the House.
That's true.
And he wasn't always in the house, but for the first 2 to 3 months, he spent a good deal of time in the house. He didn't sleep in the house. He slept in the barn in a stall next to the horses. But during the day, he had the run of the house. And, you know, because he was the size of a dog, he got along okay. But as he got bigger, the house didn't get bigger. He got bigger, and he didn't realize that he was getting bigger. So he would walk into Roger's study and then not really be able to turn around as easily as he was accustomed to. So he would force himself to do – he wouldn't back out of the study. He'd force himself to do a 180, and in doing that, he would sweep everything off the top of Roger's desk.
Oh, dear.
Well, and you mentioned that Roger was falling in love with Charlie, and that was certainly a positive experience. What were some other – what were the positive experiences that came out of this relationship?
From Roger's point of view – and it's interesting because one of the many, many things that attracted me to the story was, I think, fairly unconsciously, that Roger, who is a middle-aged man, as I am, was missing something in his life. And I think the buffalo really provided it. I mean, he provided him with a very unusual object of his affections and a challenge and an animal that probably more than almost any animal in this country has a lot of symbolic weight to it. I mean, when you first meet a buffalo, and Charlie was the first buffalo I met and the first buffalo I was licked by, it was like touching a piece of history. It's not just like having an animal. I mean, a buffalo, it's rare for most people to ever see a buffalo, and it's unusual for us to think of buffalo unless we're buffalo ranchers. So for me and for Roger, I think the fact that this is such a fantastic, haunted beast, so much a part of American history. In fact, the buffalo owned this country for thousands of years, made it a particularly rewarding relationship.
You know, you mentioned that Verl is a descendant of a man named Charles Goodnight, who played a big role in rescuing the very small numbers of bison that were sort of the few remaining herds out there. Would you tell us a little bit about Charles Goodnight and why he's such a significant figure in this story?
Charles Goodnight would have been significant even if he hadn't rescued the buffalo, because he was really one of the first great modern cattle ranchers in Texas. He always admired buffalo. And when in the 1870s he realized that the buffalo, which had once in this country numbered 50 or 60 million, in fact, as recently as 1860 or 1850, there were still 20 or 30 million buffalo in America.
Wow.
And buffalo, of course, were the basis of the entire Plains Indian civilization. Without the buffalo, that civilization couldn't exist. And in fact, the white settlers and the military knew that if they destroyed the buffalo, they would destroy Indian culture. It was, I don't want to overstate it, but it was kind of a genocide, indirect genocide.
That was part of why so many buffalo were killed, wasn't it? It wasn't just for the hides. Is that right?
Oh, no, no. In fact, the hides came later because it wasn't until, I think, the early 1870s that they figured out how to tan buffalo leather. They were killed for meat. You had a lot of people to feed on the Oregon Trail and as settlers settled the West, it was the most available meat. So in the 1870s, Charles Goodnight and his wife Mary Ann looked around and realized that the buffalo were almost all gone. There had been the greatest slaughter of living things in the history of the world, probably. 50 million buffalo, virtually all gone. And Mary Ann Goodnight turned to her husband and said, let's start a buffalo herd before it's too late. And they did. They roped out a couple calves, a boy and a girl, and they bred them. And by the time Charles Goodnight died in 1929, they had a herd of a few hundred buffalo. And if they hadn't done that, and if a couple other people, a Blackfoot Indian in the Dakotas and a couple other people hadn't somewhat by chance decided to start or preserve little buffalo herds, we would only be looking at buffalo on a plate or in a museum.
And if we move ahead about 150 years or so, Roger wanted to get in touch with the Taos Pueblo Indians to talk about their buffalo herd. Why did he want to meet with the tribe chiefs, and what came of that meeting?
Well, he had learned that some of the buffalo in the Charles Goodnight herd had ended up in Texas, in the Paladuro Canyon, after Charles Goodnight died in 1929. And they've been one of the very few pockets of wild buffalo. The others are in Yellowstone, basically. But the group in Texas has become very ingrown, genetically ingrown, which is not a good thing for any herd. But you need a variety of genes to, you know, maximize your adaptability. And this herd of buffalo hadn't had any new buffalo introduced to it for a long time. So it turned out that the Taos Pueblo had buffalo that were the perfect match. And not surprisingly, they'd gotten those buffalo from Charles Goodnight as well before he died. So Roger, who's now become a buffalo activist, went to the Taos Pueblo. I actually went with him and tried to convince them to give or even sell a few of their buffalo to the herd in Texas, which was managed by, you know, the state, and let them breed there and diversify the gene pool. And the Indians, the Taos Pueblo, said they would do it, but never did. It would have been a very nice gesture, since they got those buffalo from Charles Goodnight. And so all Roger was doing was saying, just return the favor a little bit. He gave you 30 buffalo in 1926. Can you give a couple to Texas? And to this day, they haven't done it, which, you know, says a lot about the relationship between American Indians and whites to this day. There's a tremendous amount of ambivalence. And also the Indians, which once depended so much on the buffalo, are very alienated from the buffalo. Many of the Taos Pueblo, although there is a herd there, know nothing about it. They don't depend on it for food. And many of the children there had never touched a buffalo until Roger and Verl brought Charlie to the Taos Pueblo Reservation for a kind of show and tell.
What happened to Charlie?
Well, when Charlie was 7 months old, he was too big for Roger and Verl to handle. And they introduced him to a buffalo herd owned by a friend of theirs. Unfortunately, Charlie had no idea that he was a buffalo. And when he was put in a pen with a couple other teenage buffaloes, He freaked out, and he ran right into a fence, and he partially paralyzed himself. Of course, Charlie was loved by these two people who felt they would, you know, do anything for him. And I mean, to some extent, they felt not responsible, but, you know, they had saved Charlie as an orphan and raised him in a home and then tried to introduce him to other buffalo, and it didn't work, and Charlie hurt himself, and they felt, you know, a sense of responsibility. So they took Charlie back, and Roger did something very, very extraordinary, and I think unprecedented in animal history. He rehabilitated a severely paralyzed buffalo so the buffalo could walk again and lead a normal life.
Sounds like it was an extremely complicated process as well.
And time-consuming.
Yeah.
But the kind of challenge that a guy like Roger relishes.
Well, it's a great story. And Richard, thank you so much for sharing this story about Charlie and about the American bison. Really appreciate it very much. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Richard Rosen is the author of A Buffalo in the House, The True Story of a Man, an Animal, and the American West. And he joined us today from the studios of Radio Foundation in New York City, New York. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next, with your chance to win a copy of A Buffalo in the House by Richard Rosen. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. So if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pulled together, and a winner will be selected at random to win a copy of Richard Rosen's book, A Buffalo in the House. And here's today's question. In his book, Richard talks about the founding of the American Bison Society in 1905, and the society would really devote itself to the preservation of buffalo right up until it was disbanded in 1953. In 1908, the American Bison Society counted less than 2,000 buffalo in North America. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, about how many bison live in public or private lands in the United States? Is it 150,000, 250,000, or 500,000? And again, if you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413. And check out our website. In about a week, we'll have the answer there. We'll have it posted at callingallpets.org. Time to take some more calls at 1-800-462-7413. And let's go back to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Liz. I'm calling from Plantation, Florida.
Thanks for calling, Liz. What can we do for you?
Well, we have two cats. They're 5 years old. They're litter mates, brother and sister, and we adore them. But about a year ago, we started keeping them out of our bedroom because my husband has very bad allergies to the cats. And ever since we started keeping them out at night, they tend to cry outside the door. Mm. They'll scratch at the door, check the door. And actually, just last night, I had 2 hours of crying and howling.
Oh, dear.
So I'm hoping there's some way to stop this. It's been a year.
Oh, dear. Yeah. And regrettably, one of the worst things we can do in terms of changing behavior is to intermittently reinforce something.
Right.
So,
I know.
It's so hard not to. I mean, I really do sympathize. But if 20 times, 20 nights they cried, you don't let them in, but then you let them in the 21st night, you
right.
basically taught them next time, try crying for 40 nights.
Because I know.
You never know. But, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, we all do what we have to do, don't we? But
mm-hmm.
now you need to go backwards a little bit.
Right.
So one thing to think about is do go out of your way to look at what life was like when they were inside your bedroom and
mm-hmm.
and how you can replicate that outside of the bedroom. So you might want to go outside and look at, like, how could I create a bedroom outside the bedroom? You know, is there...
They have their little down comforters wedged into the couch. So
okay.
They have little nooks and crannies.
Okay.
We have a water fountain for them so
aww.
That they can have fresh water. I think they're just spoiled, if that's
you know, in a good way.
They want what they want. So it does indeed sound like it's a pretty good life at your house.
Yeah, I think they miss the warm body and the kneading into our flesh in the middle of the night.
Well, you know, one thing you can think about, there are heating pads. Now, you need to be really careful that you're being safe. But there are, for example, there are little whelping boxes you can buy for both. Usually they're for dogs, but I think they also have the smaller ones for cats that are safe, and they're warmed underneath for the real young kittens or puppies who can't self-regulate. So if one of the things they're looking for, which is very common in cats, is warmth, you might want to look into that, given that, you know, they already sound like cats with a pretty nice life.
Yes.
You sound like you might be interested in not, you know, picking it up one more notch. But otherwise, really, the only thing you can do is just completely ignore them. Now, you could try punishment. You could try having a consequence of the meowing be you come out and spray them with water or bang in the door or put them in the basement or something like that. The problem with that is in this particular circumstance, it's gotten you up and it's gotten them attention and it's gotten you to open the door. And it might not be that, you know, you're not going to hurt them. So they might be like, yeah, well, I don't care if she's spraying me with something yucky because, you know, I got her up and out of bed. Here she is.
You know what? Teresa in Green Bay, Wisconsin, wrote in to say that she also has a pair of cats that used to meow outside her.
Ah, maybe help from a listener.
Yeah, right outside her bedroom door at 5 in the morning, waiting to be fed. They'd meow. And she actually found a unique but I guess pretty effective solution to the problem. And here's what she wrote. I discovered that my cats hate the sound of a recorder, the musical instrument. You know, that sounds almost like a whistle. I kept one by my bed, and when they started meowing in the morning, I played just a few notes. Boy, did they run. It only took about 4 days to stop the problem, and I never even had to get out of bed.
And that's perfect because she also didn't have to open the door, which is a reinforcement, the reinforcement I was worried about. So if you're lucky enough to have cats who don't like a particular kind of sound, now it might be that they only don't like drums or something. That might be a bit of a problem.
But a recorder would be
really
worth it.
Interesting, unique solution. A recorder, that little tiny flute-like instrument, that would be a great idea.
And it's and thanks again to Liz for calling. And again, for pet tips, we love them.
We love them.
How do you send that pet tip in?
Yeah, just send us an email. Send it to pets@wpr.org.
And to call, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, I'm Jeff from Anchorage.
Anchorage, Alaska. Jeff, hi. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have some questions about training my dog, Max. He's got a very poor recall.
Okay.
And I'm having a hard time keeping his attention during training classes. His name is M-A-X-X, and he deserves that extra X for all the extra energy that he's got, number one.
Okay.
And he came to us about 9 months ago. We've been going to obedience classes. He's been through 3 obedience classes now, and now he's in agility class.
Great.
Which is great for him.
So what can we help you with specifically?
Well, specifically is like in agility class, we try to work off leash. And when I take him off leash and he runs, like, say, through a tunnel, and he's supposed to return to me and, you know, click, treat, you know, return to me. Well, he doesn't want to.
Yeah.
He likes to go play with the other dogs.
Uh-huh.
He wants to run across the room and go visit my wife,
uh-huh,
who's been watching. And he'll just do this time and time again. And so I'm hoping you can give me a tip on extra reinforcement or something I can do to help this recall and his attention.
Sure. One of the things you can do is you can teach him, now this should be out of the context at first of an agility class, but you can teach him, maybe you could get to the agility equipment with just, say, one other dog that's a friend of his, for example. And what you can teach him is, if after you come out of the tunnel, you come to me, then I'll say, okay, and you can go play with the other dog. So in other words, make attention to you, make what he wants contingent on giving you attention first. So say, for example, he comes out of the tunnel and you have a little treat in your hand. So he can choose. I can come to Dad and I can get this little treat, or I can run away because I'm free and I can go to another dog and play. Well, what he's telling us is, what I really want – is to go to another dog and play. I want that more than I want the treat. So what you want to do is figure out a way that he gets what he wants by doing what you want. Got it?
Okay.
So you set up situations where maybe you do have him on a leash at first, or maybe a long line might be a good idea. So he comes out of the tunnel, and I would at first, I would be right there at the exit of the tunnel, and I would have, first of all, I would up the treat. So if you're giving him really good treats, I would move to a piece of steak or something, you know, a hunk of chicken, really. And that might be competitive with that other dog. And then you're going to just lure him a little bit towards you, away from the exit of the tunnel. And then you're going to say, okay. And then he gets to go run and play with the other dog. And you do that 5 times in a row. So that's one of the keys. When you have a dog who's there's something that's out-competing you in terms of what your dog is interested in. Right. One, you need to look at what you're giving him. Is it really good enough? So maybe the treats aren't good enough. So maybe you need to be upping them and making them a hunk of meat or something like that. Two, use what he really wants as reinforcement. So you might not be able to do that in class. I think your class instructor can probably help you. You might want to set up some situations where you're not bothering all the other people in class, but you're letting him go play with another dog when he attends to you. So that's what I'd work on. Give those kind of things a try and see if you can make some progress that way.
And thanks a lot for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate the call very much. And Patricia, we had great calls today and great topics. Thank you. And tell you what, we'll do it again next week.
Well, I certainly hope so. I'll be here. You better be here, Mueller.
I will be. Patricia McCottle is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Kirill Owen is our technical director, and Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0202P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.